Hello, welcome to Diving Into the Wreckage, where we have long since given up trying to keep up with any numbering system, and we are calling this episode Independence, Decadence, and Renewal. And this episode kind of came out of a comment I made that I don't think you could ignore contemporary politics when doing organizing, and and you said that you did, and I wanted to go into why I don't think our positions are actually that different, because when I say we can't ignore it, I do not think, and I'm not one of these people who thinks that what the Democrats are doing from the day to day radically affects anything that we need to do. And
okay, we agree on that then.
Yeah. And what we have to deal with, however, is that for good or ill, mostly for ill, the labor movement in the United States seems to be unable to be independent.
Yeah.
Mostly tied to the Democrats or the AFL-CIO, but, you know, Teamsters doing Teamster shit going back to Nixon, but that's still, what people talk about that as labor independence, and I'm like, it's...
Not quite.
It's not really, no.
It doesn't, like, it doesn't posit its own institutions as independent from the state, parastate, party apparatus alongside, like, NLRB regime. Nor does it imagine that an independent labor-driven politics could arise separate from those two others. So it's not independent in the way that we might want it to be.
Right. I would.
Did you see not- the? Did you see the flack I caught from the from my Left Reckoning appearance last week?
No, I did not. I don't follow.
I don't follow that
anymore.
Yeah, but I forgot what a what place I was wading into when I went back into that Majority Report world. They were very gracious to have me on, but I didn't read the comments. But I heard the comments were excoriating, just positing like a concept that the working class needs to be functionally independent from the two main parties, but especially the Democrats. And not that Sean O'Brien, speaking at the teachers' convention, or the RNC represents that, but that, like, the specter of independence itself scares the shit out of many, many, you know, good-hearted progressive people, and we shouldn't be scared by that. In fact, that's, I think, for us, or at least for me and my project with my people, a productive tension right there, or at least a way to separate, because this all started with me commenting positively upon how people that I work with saw O'Brien's message of independence from the two political parties as a positive.
Right. Well, I sent you a bunch of reporting done by Cosmonaut, and this actually was reporting for once, not just theory, about what had been going on in the Teamsters for a Democratic Union. And it put in perspective to me that there is something shady going on there. I have thought about the Tale of Two Seans a lot.
I'm not one of them, right? You're talking about O'Brien and Fain.
Yep. Sean Fain and Sean O'Brien.
Okay, good.
Yeah, you are a third Sean.
Leave me out of it.
And I also think about the career of one of my least favorite media figures, who claims to be a rank and file union organizer, Honda Wong from the DSA.
Oh, I've heard of them. Yeah.
Yeah, I do not like the Honda Wong of the world.
Kind of the right wing of the DSA, right?
Yeah, this is one of the dangers of following the Democratic politics too closely and convincing yourself prematurely that you are having an influence on it, because you might change their messaging on something, maybe, is the way in which the right wing of the DSA, and by that we mean what we can broadly call the Democratic, a party adjacent electoral ring, as opposed to the independent electoral ring. There's also the non-electoral wing that's basically the Libertarian Socialist Caucus and the Communist Caucus, but those are the three broad coalitions of factions in the DSA's leadership. And also, we have no idea, because when I actually find out the number of people in most of these fucking caucuses, I'm like, well, how big are you really? Most of you are only 400 people, like in an organization of probably 56,000 paper members at this point. The last report I see is quite bad. That's why you're getting more and more from the DSA left. Like, yeah, we know it sucks. Please join.
Like, right.
The reason why following the Democratic Party stuff too closely, as if you have an effect on it, is that you can convince yourself that 50,000 paper activists, which probably stands to 10,000 people who post and do union organizing. And one thing I will say about the DSA has a lot of influence on staffers in unions around New York. So this is not, I am not saying the DSA is powerless. In addition to it, they have a long-standing congressional caucus that even predates the renewal in New York. Mm-hmm. And that's about really that's their real tendrils of power, if we are quite honest.
Going back to the mayoralty of what's his face back in the 80s.
Yep.
I'm blanking on our old mayor, black guy, forget his name, but he was a DSA dude.
So
they've had power for a bit.
Yeah, I mean, he was part of and that's when the DSA and the Harringtonite factions were part of the Rainbow Coalition under Jesse Jackson. And
right.
You know, and I recently made fun of that by saying that these people who are still crying about Bernie would be like crying about Jesse Jackson in 2000. And then I got some of those people telling me they were still upset about Jesse Jackson. And I was like, okay.
I think I lose my NYC card for not remembering the name of David Dinkins. I got to get my head in the cave, man. Jeez. I even remember that from being a kid.
So this is my, but it's clear to me now that the DSA right is tailing in a liquidationist sense. Like, I don't know why the DSA would still exist if they achieve what they want to achieve.
Right.
And they're doing it at a moment where their electeds, and for those of you who are listening and not watching, I put electeds in quotation marks. And I don't think actually DSA has that much to do with why these people got elected. They're losing. Now, there's a story about AIPAC around that, and that story is true. But let me tell you what I think AIPAC is actually doing. Yeah, AIPAC is punishing these progressives who stood up to the occupation, Bowman and Bush. But I will tell you that they're not doing that with Rashida Tlaib or Ilhan Omar. Or even AOC. And the reason why they're not is it's not the AIPAC money that's defeating those candidates. And I know this is going to be very controversial on the left, but a lot of people are like, oh, AIPAC is just destroying them. AIPAC is probably helping them be destroyed. I'm not saying it has no effect, but they're not targeting all of the occupation resistors. They're targeting the weak ones.
The weak ones, the ones who already existing tensions within their local party and national politics leads them to be weak. Because if I understand, and again, this is like, do we follow electoral politics? You know, are we with the times? I know enough to know that Cori Bush wasn't even specifically attacked in AIPAC-funded ads for her stance on Palestine so much as rejecting the Inflation Reduction Act, right? And infrastructure spending, the vote that she did.
And the Build Back Better bill, which actually put her in tension with labor and in her district.
Right.
Bauman has had a ton of problems to begin with. And it was clear to me in the DSA, there's this big kerfuffle, which is the last time I really interacted with David Griscom. Because I said, you know, people going after Bowman are fine to do it. And he was like, well, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, well, if you can't pressure people, you know, who are obstinately on the left who would respond to you, then what the fuck is the point of your politics? And he basically, he insulted me. And I was like, well, you know, you can go be a sheepdog, is what I more or less said.
A lot of those out there these days.
But you know, and David's really mad at the Democratic Party. He says really prescient things about them, but in no world does he believe they can cut from them, at least not yet.
Well, this is maybe a substantive point that I can bring up here for paying attention or not paying attention to like broader political trends in American life. I like to think I keep up with things, right? What's happening with the Democrats, with the Republicans, obviously geopolitics. I would never claim that you shouldn't like read the paper or watch the news or whatever it is to get an understanding of what the terrain looks like. But what I feel has to end, and I know for a fact you won't disagree with me on that, is the intense feelings of betrayal that people get when the Democratic Party, for example, or the Republican Party, when it comes to the folks who stand on the sideline and yell, rhinos, rhinos, getting disappointed as though you're being betrayed, or that the Democratic Party is betraying its own principles, right? That like there is a progressivist core at the center of the party that nefarious members or nefarious groups are trying to undermine, or that the heart and soul of it is progressivism. It's just that, you know, there's betrayalists there's traitors at the center of the project. That's what needs to be ditched. We should pay attention to the larger political trends and what's going on with the two big parties, but we should be doing so dispassionately from the outside. Absolutely. Analyzing the structures in place, the power bases there, not even imagining at this early date that we could split any forces off from those parties, but look at, as AIPAC would do, I say this semi-ironically, look at where the weak spots are, look at where wedges can be formed. And I think for me, the number one wedge that I saw in that recent appearance on Griscom and Lex's show is this, is the Popular Front, is the conception of class independence, which I think is a very productive place to start drawing distinctions between people. Maybe people who vote for Democrats, maybe people who have given money to Democrats or their union endorses Democrats, right? But at least pushing forward the idea of an independence from that.
Yeah, well, I think this is interesting because we can talk about the way locals versus national unions work a little bit here.
Yeah.
Like, my union is hostile to the union that we are in. My union, which is a branch of the UEA. I'm not going to say the specific branch because that would give away my day job.
Yeah, but, don't self-dox yourself. I won't do the same.
But as a branch of the UEA, the UEA is in a very delicate position in regards to the NEA. The NEA, by a lot of the members of the UEA, is seen as a Democratic Party hack. Mm-hmm. That does not mean those members are all Republicans, although some of them are, and there are structural reasons for that. I could go into that, but the difference in cost of membership and maintaining your fucking building is one of the reasons. Like it's very expensive to join the union in Salt Lake City. It's very cheap in Granite County. Our Rock County, excuse me, are outside of Moab, which is very sparsely populated, and they basically don't have operating costs. So our union is disproportionately not just suburban, but rural represented in a state that is 90% urban. And I think people don't understand this about Utah. Utah is uninhabitable, except in the urban areas. Like, you can't really live there. It's a fucking rock pit desert that's mostly federal lands.
So, unless you're in the beautiful glacial springs of like Park City, Utah, which I've
been to. Unless you're in Park City, if you're in three valleys, Utah Valley, Salt Lake Valley, and Cache Valley, and all those valleys have urbanized. Like, you know, they're not New York level urban, but they are, for the West, really urban. And I also think East Coasters don't realize sometimes, unless they spent time out here, that until you hit the West Coast, it really is not that urbanized. Like, the first time I went to a major city in the West, I was like, this is it? This is a mid-sized city in the South. Like,
dude, I've been to Denver a couple times now, and I spent a decent amount of time there about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And it's even as a large urban agglomeration, it's a different type of urban landscape than you would imagine out East, too.
Right. And, well, the big cities out here in like area, they're more like Jacksonville, Florida. That's like Vegas and Phoenix, right? Mm. But the point, and this stuff kind of matters when you're trying to figure out why there's all these union tensions and why it's hard to get unions to grow. Because there's two different distrusts of the Democratic Party here. the urban teachers are actually, well, for the most part, to the left of the center of the Democratic Party. They're still progressives, but like, you know, although occasionally I would meet people in the union who were like, I don't know, PSL adjacent or DSA adjacent. Like, it does happen.
Yeah, even out here. I have too, yeah.
But our union operates independently because if we were just focused on the Democrats, we would be dead in the water in Utah. Like, there's no way for us not to. That's why I was laughing about people like, oh, you endorse Republicans, you must be a fascist. I'm like, we endorse Republicans all the time. We just don't do it at a national level.
Exactly. Like, yeah. No, this and that was one of the great disconnects, too. I saw the rhetoric of Red Brown Alliance, because we'd be dead in the water on Staten Island if our district council didn't endorse some Republicans. We'd be dead in North Jersey, and we'd be dead in Nassau and Suffolk County and parts of Westchester too. Like, that this is a mercenary game, and that this is an opportunistic game, and that's what you would expect from the sort of business unionism that's like built into the American system should not be a surprise to people. We can start making critiques on these basic structures, which go back 80 years, and very, very brave people have fought against for decades and decades and decades, including the Teamsters for the Democratic Union. But taking like larger, broader, like national political happenings and try to like fit this union issue into them, I think is a dead end. And also reflective, I think, of how tied people are to a particular narrative, a narrative of Trump, and a narrative of Democrats, and a narrative of Popular Front to stop fascism, blah, blah, blah. So people shouldn't be as ignorant about this stuff, I would
argue. And people, when they talk about the Popular Front, and that's like the high period of communist involvement, they're right, but then they completely ignore that even in places that didn't go through a Red Scare, as soon as the war was over, those Popular Fronts started collapsing. Like, immediately.
Yeah.
And what ended up happening for the communist parties that were common form aligned, which is the organization that was mostly a USSR
propaganda outlet
at that point. Yeah, because they'd gotten rid of the Comintern because it was too uppity after 1942.
Yeah.
And also, Stalin had killed too many of the leaders of different communist parties for anyone to trust it anymore.
Plus, we're looking at a détente with the capitalist West. So why have like this allegedly subversive organization?
Exactly.
Before we go on into the Popular Front stuff, I want to share a parallel story with you about the history of endorsements and politics with our union, you know, because the Carpenters Union has like hundreds of thousands of members. It's giant. Starting under the Obama administration, this is an interesting parallel I just thought of. Similar to famously Obama during his first and second term, the Democratic Party became a national party. It like lost a lot of its local, municipal, state representatives and politicians across the country. There was like in houses and senates in individual states, the Democrats got absolutely fucking creamed. While of course under Obama, the Democrats nationally were doing well. Similar thing in the so while this kind of top down process is taking place, a similar thing happens in the Carpenters Union, where a lot of the power of various district councils and locals to make substantive decisions about contracts, decisions on the ground, police our own work, have strong locals, which are able to maintain a sort of like social autonomy from not just the rest of the trades, but also like a fighting power against the bosses itself. A lot of that got undermined. This is around this time of Andy Stern, too, in the SEIU. So there was a vast centralization of power to where the international went, which was, of course, Las Vegas out west. So you've got this grand and growing disconnect between what's happening at the international United Brotherhood of Carpenters in Las Vegas versus what's happening on the ground level, which is a real evacuation of what was left of union democracy and a real like subordination of district council, which is like the medium level in this umbrella, district council and council imperatives towards like a centralization, which flies in the face really of the way that craft unionism had worked in the United States for the last 100 years, creating now, and I think this is true in a lot of the different trades, creating sort of like a zombie craft unionism, where even like the regressive parts of skilled trade unionism, like the exclusion of people that used to still retain some sort of democratic parts to it once you were inside this labor racket. But now you don't even have like the direct democracy so much anymore as like a top down craft unionism, which I think we're seeing the effects of that as more and more jobs decline.
Well, I think we'll see. Yeah, we'll talk about jobs, because one thing that there seems to be right now, and I don't think it's from like hyper automation from LLMs that people think is, because LLMs are not that effective. But that the false boost that we saw in LLM investment, and Ed Citron covers this quite well, has been a lot of what's been keeping our GDP numbers high. And GDP numbers don't care about the legitimacy of what's keeping them high. Like, this is something you always have to know. Like,
what's an LLM specifically?
A large language model. That's what we call AI. I don't call it AI for the most part, because it doesn't think.
Fair enough. Not even artificially.
No, it doesn't. You can train them, but they do not learn from experience of utterance to utterance after the training. So there's no, it is not accumulating knowledge. It's very good. I mean, it did lead to some layoffs in coding and stuff, because it gets rid of a lot of, it gets rid of a lot of entry-level shit work. It does, but beyond that, it only leads to minimum gains at efficiency at the high cost of power resources on the back end.
Oh my God. Yeah. We're burning up like the equivalent of entire small nations worth of electricity, yeah, just so that you're, phone can tell you some dubious information about like the breeding habits of meerkats or whatever the fuck people look
right
up on a day-to-day basis.
And the AI hallucinates, and that's, I'm gonna put that in quotations, so I don't think we should call it hallucinations. I think we should,
that gives it
AI
too much credit.
Right? It's bullshitting.
Yeah,
it's been programmed to bullshit.
It's programmed for like, no, it takes inputs and then it gives probabilistic outputs, right? And then it hones those over time based on like user input, right?
That's the idea. So a lot of people think that that's going to lead to a massive layoff. I think what the problem is we've had a lot of unvalorizable economic activity tied to AI, yeah, and a lot of promises that AI is going to reduce the workforce. Obviously it hasn't, because if it had, I guarantee you the Fed would be lowering the base level interest rate. It's not, right. But it does seem they're finally getting their recession almost perfectly timed to hit after the election.
That was so well arranged,
you know. So for those of you who always come to me and say, well, you know, after 2007 and with the advent of QE and all that, there's no more business cycle. Heard claims about that. You know, we heard it in the 50s with monopoly capital, yeah, you know, whatever the current left dominant fad is. They're always like, oh, we've solved this problem because of currency manipulation or whatever. Right. Like,
and what did they say? The computer revolution could be seen anywhere except in productivity numbers. I feel like this most recent spurt of hundreds of billions of dollars of an investment in AI, where's the productivity gains? Because we haven't seen.
There's not even profit gains.
There's not even profits at this point in time. It reminds me of, you know, what happened 3-4 years ago, where for a decade or so, everybody who's been a truck driver or perhaps interested in getting their CDL working for a large firm has been told day in and day out that their job is like a couple of years from being automated away. And then all of a sudden the COVID crisis hit and there was labor scarcities across the board. And it turns out that we didn't have enough truck drivers because this automation is always 1 or 2 years away. The AI hype was an investor's hype. It was trying to spin an unproven technology into actual real world gains, yeah, for capital. And I think it's going to fall on its face similar to self-driving cars or automated trucks, because it's just not there yet. And also the incentive to do it for a lot of these jobs isn't there, as like white collar workers in America, the kind of jobs you would be replacing, those people remain cheap despite all the inflation. They remain cheap and exploitable.
Some people who think that we're going through, yeah, that, you know, that you and I are going through this in a very unsystematic way, and in some way we are. But I want to tie this into the 1950s. Yeah. The end of the Popular Front falls out in the 1950s. And there's a couple reasons why. One, Fordism develops, and that and European social democracy abandons any pretense of even its Bernsteinism and its LaSalleanism and goes over to Keynes.
Mm-hmm.
Which means basically the level of state involvement is different because Fordism is more public-private partnership that's mostly private, and Keynesian social democracy is more public-private partnership that's slightly more public. But they actually structurally resemble each other in a lot of ways. The American version is less efficient and is dependent on monopolies staying monopolies for a long time. But that's when you saw the Marxist, even in the Soviet Union, I was like, Lipmantov apparently was doing this, saying that like the problems of capital are done. LVT, the transformation problem critique is fixed. We can deal with this with currency and management. All you have to do is change management. That's when you see the proliferation of James Burnhamite theories of the managerial class. But you also see it on the left in Frederick Pollock and the Frankfurt School and in Baron and Sweezy's Monopoly Capital. They all basically posit similar things.
Yeah.
And what happens then, for those of you who don't know, is this Communist Party is aligned to the common form, move to the right often of the socialist parties that were instantiated behind them, which leads to people who were radicalized, not just under, you know, high Marxist-Leninism and war communism, but just in general. They either become different kinds of radical liberals, or they become... or they start splitting off into these new sects. So they you have the plethoration of Charstiest sects in this period. But what is often missed is we have a plethoration of Marxist-Leninist sects and Maoist sects. And I've actually counted, there's five different forms of Maoism before you even get to Dengism. Like And these were not just like Western inventions. They were coming off of dialogues of tensions of also pivots in the CPC and in the USSR. And I bring this up because this was also the time period where we saw a lot of weird trends from a defeated right. Yaquiism comes from this time period. The invention of the Rockwell Nazi Party in America comes from this time period. These things also come out of this time.
Because it's also a time of the consolidation of like the William F. Buckley National Review right, which purposefully tries to keep like at least the most odious anti-Semites, the most odious fascists out of the official.
The most obvious neo-Confederates, et cetera.
Even the John Birchers, right, are left out.
But yeah, the Birchers are left out, but Bircher adjacent people are brought in very stealthily over time. And the reason why that happens is actually, this is actually a Utah connection, believe it or not, was that there was a faction in the LDS Church conspiring for it to happen.
For what to happen? For the Birchers to be brought quietly in?
But the Birchers to be brought quietly in and make an allegiance with the evangelicals. And it was done
Benson. Mm-hmm. Yeah, wasn't one of the most famous, like, Bircher-esque conspiracy theorists a Mormon?
Yes.
What was his name? I it's on the tip of my tongue.
Skousen.
Yes, thank you, Skousen. A lot of dissident right, quote-unquote, online will still reference him.
Cleon Skousen, and they actually also, like, came up with their own Constitution Center and all this stuff, but it was deliberately, not to sound conspiratorial, but living in Utah, sometimes we have to talk about... the MQ, the Mormon question.
In every town, you got a big white building and there's people inside, elders with a lot of power who talk with one another and decide things about what millions of people are going to do with their vote.
It is the second richest church in the world, and it is the first richest church in liquid assets. So,
a lot of juice, a lot of power to push around.
So Benson and Skousen, Ezra Taft Benson was the more reputable form of that. He was almost a vice president for George Wallace. He was actually prevented by the Quorum of the 12 from doing so. So this is like all weird religious shit. But this, and for those of you who don't know, this really had massive effects in American politics because they are the bridge between the Birchers and the evangelicals coming together on something, which became like the Shafleyite circle.
And the fusion.
Yeah. The reason why I bring this up, all right, and for those of you who don't know, this is not a conspiracy theory. The centrist stuff in America, including Buckley, but also on the left, like Gloria Steinem, they weren't under the direct direction of the CIA like you hear sometimes, but they were CIA operatives at different times in their lives and seemed to be part of that general vision of bringing everyone towards a center of American life, a liberal consensus.
Yes.
I bring this up now because in some ways we are in the bizarro decadent version of a similar time period.
Mm.
And the reason why I say we're in a bizarro decadent version of that is there is no Soviet Union to fund all this stuff. There is no historical Comintern aligned parties anymore. Even in Europe, most of the communist parties do not, like, the current Communist Party of Italy is not related to the 40s Communist Party of Italy, which is barely related to the 20s Communist Party of Italy. Like, it's, these are literally different organizations. And the exception does seem to be France. We can go into that a little later. But these parties in the 50s moved to the right of the socialist parties and also tailed conservative issues while basically lying about their positions, which is what the Red Scare people in the 40s at the state level and the 50s at the national level were able to pick up on, that these people were lying about their positions. And it wasn't always cutting right, though. There was also basically like, anti-racism campaigns, anti-nationalist campaigns, but that was simultaneously too, like, communism is 21st century Americanism. Whereas the right very much had a disestablishment right that was ascending and making some concessions to the establishment, but was a real dangerous thing. I mean, part of the things with Ezra Taft Benson and what later people around the Birchers were trying to do is, in addition to their weird conspiratorial stuff, was to soften that so they were more appealing to general society. Mm-hmm. Evangelical Christians were not, by and large, identified with the right wing consistently until the 1970s. And in the 19th century, they were way more likely than Catholics to be aligned with the People's Party.
Right.
William Jennings Bryan being the prime example.
Yep.
But you know, as the People's Party's sharecropper base fell, they are, even before the Stalinists, they're the people who started what we could call a popular front. Like, mm-hmm. they entered the Democratic Party en masse when the Democratic Party was actually the most reactionary party in American life, which is something that people, like, don't deal with. They think that, oh, William Jennings Bryan was a progressive, the Democratic Party was the progressive party. No, the progressives emerged initially before FDR, actually out of the GOP.
Yes, out of the Republican, like, Party. And the Democratic Party represented neo-Confederates, segregationists, and the urban machines in the North and the Midwest and the West, which were retrogressive. They were paternalistic, but they were reactionary in their own ways.
Yeah, they were retrogressive. And I would say that's why it's so hard to talk about, like, even European style liberalism or conservatism in the US until basically after World War II. Like, we were at that point, and I will say, even though I'm very much, we were always an empire, we were from moment one, but at that point we were not a hegemonic empire. And if you were going to guess where progressive legislation or progressive social movements or what benefits to workers were going to come out of, you would actually say probably the US and not Europe at that time.
Yeah.
There's a lot of studies on this and by socialists in the early 20th century. Today that's effectively flipped. My point about this now, though, and the reason why I say this is a farcical version of it, is because I do think there's some organizational involvement, but this is basically vibes. Like, what happened with a lot of the communists is under the Red Scare, they did liquidate into the Democratic Party or left public life altogether. And we can see that in the fact that the Popular Front was maintained by the CPUSA informally, actually probably until 2018. But like, you had Communist Party black leaders like Lorraine Hansberry, who were in the arts, going to meet Democratic anti-communists like Robert Kennedy in the 60s. Like, it was not unheard of. So, and the Birchers were seizing on that. And the Birchers were seizing on the amount of communists in like the State Department, which there were. That's not made up.
Because
of the Popular Front. So,
especially in Treasury and in like various of the New Deal programs, you had like the mid-level apparatchiks, and in some cases higher level people who were fellow travelers at least. But this story is interesting. We should continue it, but it like reminds me of something that Alex Gendler said years back that always stuck with me, which is like, you have this sort of neo-Bircherite accusation that Kamala Harris is a communist, you know, and that the Democratic Party is communist. And it sounds completely implausible, right? Except if you view it from like a petty bourgeois, like reactionary standpoint, which sees in like the combination of the big welfare state and also corporations and the corporate state, the closest thing that can approximate unfreedom to them, not having an actual communist movement to face. It seems plausible for these people that like when Joe Biden goes and he gives money to like ExxonMobil or gives it to like a car company or goes to support the union members, that like this is an abridgment of like the basic premises of freedom in the United States from this libertarian perspective. So their critique of communism, and I'm not saying that they're like natural allies or whatever, misses the mark, but does so in a really important and interesting way. Because even as right-wing psychopaths, even as like neo-Birchers, they're recognizing something about the nature of capitalism and the state in this late decadent period about the confluence of corporate and state power at the same time. I think like ultimately, right, we're not going to win these people over, but their views on Harris being a communist are symptomatic, I think, of like the weird and prismatic way that like American petty bourgeois try to understand the vast changes that are happening in American life and in the economy since like the Wilsonian period, or certainly since the New Deal period.
Yeah. Although, I mean, we have to also admit that it ends up marrying fascist arguments that the Jews both created capitalism and communism the fuck over the
guy. Oh, yeah.
Real German.
Well, you can get that on the left too, because it's instead of Jews, it's Zionists.
but the way in which we kind of have to look at this independence and why this is so important, and why it's not a project of just like going and voting for an independent third party in the fucking presidential election. Then when I say this, people misunderstand me as like, oh, you want me to throw a vote my way and vote for Jill Stein? No. And in fact, you should vote your fucking conscience locally and know that it's a waste of time nationally anyway. But like there are allegiances to be made with local politicians, even if you want to overthrow them.
Like, even opportunistic ones, you know,
right.
Like O'Brien might have done over at the RNC there. Yeah, this is important, right? Because this.
Well, why do we say O'Brien's opportunistic and we don't say Sean Fain's opportunistic for what he's now done with the DNC?
Because like, that is you're supposed to stay on one of the two plantations. It's straying off the Democrat plantation that is a absolute like abridgment of the principles of solidarity and organized labor, whereas, you know, of course, selling yourself out to Biden and company, or allowing, say, like Biden and the Democratic Congress to like abrogate the right of railroad workers to go on strike, as happened a couple of years ago, and then like kind of getting them a backhanded deal a few months later to get
only some of them.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And meanwhile, the IBEW comes out of the gate as the first union to endorse Biden, because functional independence, of course, is not what they're looking for. They're looking for state guarantees of work and pensions.
And we should think about why the UAW in particular would do that, because the car industry is one of the most tied into the state sector because it's at this point uncompetitive on the national market.
Absolutely.
It's barely competitive in Europe, and it absolutely cannot compete with
Chinese electric cars. Yeah.
Absolutely cannot. Like, Tesla would be decimated if we let Chinese electric cars in here.
But the
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, this is, let's not gloss over, I think, a really substantive point, which says a lot, I think, about where the left is and how far our imagination is from like the kind of necessary organizational and institutional steps that would be necessary to create like a true option, like a third option. Is that when you say independence, as you said, immediately people think you, oh, is that vote for RFK or is that a vote for Jill Stein? There's such a mindset, you know, that like if
voting
if,
is a primary political activity.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And that is the killer mind frame. That is the frame that means that we can't ever get anything done because it's always going to put us back into the pockets, going to put us back into the interests of some larger capitalist force, even if that's like the Greens, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, the story of the Greens and the DSA is like the story of the DSA and the SPUSA. For those of you who don't know my acronyms here, you guys all know the DSA because of 2014. I forget what the America, it was America something group that Camejo founded that separated from Camejo when Camejo founded the Green Party, is the group that joined with the United Social Democrats, I think. No, that's but they were in Germany. Whatever, our Social Democratic Party that came after Shachtman killed the original Socialist Party of America in the 60s. Harrington came out of that Social Democratic movement shepherded by Shachtman, and he actually deliberately tried, and this is funny because I learned this from reading Christopher Lash, and Lash later on endorsed populism, but in the 60s and 70s he endlessly mocked Harrington for trying to do a left populism that also tied people back to the Democratic Party. And I hate to tell people, but that actually is the birth of modern presidential politics. The 68 convention leads to the primary reforms in the states for most of the states where, you know, they existed in caucuses and primaries in some states going way back, but most of them did not have them. They were handled by state conventions. And there was very little involvement of the general public in the selection of candidates by their parties, the way there is actually still in Europe. Like people don't really vote for, Corbyn didn't become the leader of Labour because people voted for him to be the leader of Labour outside of the Labour Party. It was that the Labour Party MPs and the apparatus voted for him.
Yes, yeah. Because there are more parties than our parties are parties, right? More, in Europe, they tend to have more traditional parties than we do, with membership and duties and dues and all that.
Right. America is the home of mass-based voter-influenced parties. The Germany is the home of mass parties in general, like in the way that we think of like the Socialist Party or whatever. And the SPD is one of the first, but, one of the first of any mass size anyway, but my point is in the 1960s, we, in trying to democratize all this in response to a similar crisis, a very similar crisis, you know, of unpopular war. It's a direct war, not an indirect war, but still it starts off as an indirect war though. People being radicalized in the student movement, but coming out of what is essentially a Democratic Party apparatus and sentient young Democrats after the Popular Front was over and had been buried more or less by the Red Scare and by Eisenhower. It leads to this weird initial excitement about Camelot and then fraying. And then a right-wing figure actually comes in, does a lot of what the left asked for in terms of foreign policy, believe it or not. I mean, Nixon was brutal about it, but he did it.
Yeah.
And then the ugliness of American foreign policy still braids its head. But what happens is a slow fragmentation where some people become further and further radicalized. That's when we see the beginnings of American forms of third worldism, aka Jay Sakai. I mean, this is from this time period, right? And then in the 80s, most of this stuff becomes either subcultures or it dies. And the question becomes, like, where did 2 million socialists and communists in America go?
Yeah, wither the new communist movement.
Right, yeah. Wither the new communist movement, wither the new left. They both disappeared for the most part. We know where most of the new left went, right? But we don't actually, it's people don't ask the question. And I used to ask the question after reading Max Elbaum's book.
Yeah.
Where did they go? We're seeing this now. One of the things I want to talk about is Twitter in particular, X, whatever the fuck you want to call it, even though it's way more of a right-wing thing than it used to be, can still give you this feeling that radicalization is common in a very in a time period where it actually, from the stats, we see depoliticization and de-radicalization in young people.
And where at the same time as the rhetoric ratchets up online among like the 100,000 or so people who are committed ideological posters on that site.
Right. So let's talk about the Bowman affair. This is, you know, the new one. You know, there's been a bunch, but yeah. with Bowman having this AIPAC opponent, and there's, you know, there's this Palestinian group that's opposing him and protesting him, and that's causes like this is my big fight with the David Griscom, right? One of the things that happens in this that I pointed out watching this, Bowman's in New York, correct?
Yeah, Westchester. Yeah.
Yeah. I watched the rally for Bowman and the counter protest as recorded online with AOC and Bernie being there in Westchester.
Mm-hmm.
There were like 200 people there and like 50 counter protesters. That was it.
Depressing. Yeah.
Like, and I'm just saying, like, so you guys have this 100,000 post funeral furor about these this thing online, and these motherfuckers can't even bother to show up in Westchester if they're there, and I bet a lot of them aren't, but like and, so there's
and if we debate. If we had to guess, you know, probably some of those 200 people were like committed online posters slash activists in the DSA or the Young Democrats or whatever. But many of them, too, were probably just constituents in this district. And how much do they know of, like, the Bowman controversies except what they see on TV ads? And maybe they're fans of, like, Bernie and AOC, and so they show up. But the difference in, I have to imagine, the difference in affect and ideology between the Twitter people freaking out about Bowman on the one hand and the actual constituents in Westchester and the Bronx, I think there's probably a huge gulf there.
Well, one thing we have to talk about is, you know, we mentioned tech about its larger effects on our economy earlier, and this is why the decadence is related to this. For people who think we're going all over the place, we are, but this is all related. That's why that's why it's going all over the place. The point I want to make about tech is tech in particular has been taken over by the same kind of management philosophy that affected neoliberals and short-termism in the 80s. Mm. Now, there's now a movement of like progressives who are, you know, who are fighting for a better capitalism, for the end of short-termism, for the end of stark whole. And then I'm like, well, that only works if you really believe that old commodity capitalism is infinitely profitable, which unfortunately, and I'm going to say this today, the left believes more than the right. There are more leftists who will argue that there's no such thing as a declining rate of profits because they don't understand the difference between commodities and rents. Or they'll say that we're in neo-feudalism because they don't understand that rents have always been commoditized in capital. That's something even Marx notices explicitly. That they're missing what is happening, which is a reason why there's this big impetus to move towards rentier capitalism, is that it's not that profitability is nothing, but the profitability for a physical commodity right now is pretty fucking low. And almost every economist I know, when I read it, will admit that.
Yes.
Like, it's literally Marxist influencing by Keynesian and modern monetary theory who will deny it, right? Because they seem to think that we think that value and value production is about nominal currency, right? And it is true. Like, the federal government can't run out of money because it's not like our money is fiat. Like, absolutely. You're completely correct. That doesn't actually explain that much in the economy.
Like, yeah. And it's fascinating to see where they think the AI, or where we shouldn't even say where they think, where the AI productivity gains, the alleged ones that are soon to come down the pipe, are meant to be located. And they're not in physical commodity production, of course. They're in the sort of white collar and service jobs that have been largely immune to productivity increases over the last 50 to 100 years or so, right? So right. It's almost like giving up, except like this promise that the AI revolution is also going to lead to a robotics revolution. Like, I'm sorry, that revolution's already happened. And it happened 50 and 100 years ago, except right. for that. And like, even the fruit, the low-hanging fruit they're looking for is, like, law clerks and, like,
and there's no way that statistical probability-based LLMs, even trained on large data set models, which they're running out of data sets for, by the way, there's no way that they can actually do what they're said to do without massive increases in computing power. I didn't know that was called compute.
We learn something new every day when it comes to tech. I'm just noticing
how this, like, we're quitting conjugating verbs. That's where we are now. You know, whatever. That's just language. Language does weird shit. But my the compute and power needs are insane. And really people will go, well, it only takes like, someone actually responded to me. What only takes like LED level to run AI model on your computer, on my computer. And I'm like, not if you're running a full AI program at scale to be able to access the entire internet, The amount of power that uses is astronomical. And it does not have any efficiency coded into it at all, because if it does, it can't do what it needs to do.
I wonder if like computing away, let's say like a low level secretarial job, or even like a low level, like advertising job, right? If you turn that into AI, I wonder if the calories used to create that algorithm and run it to replace that job is more or less than the physical calories that a human being takes.
Has actually done the calculations more.
Really? And
it also costs more.
Oh my God. What a fucking boondoggle.
And the problem is right now, is that it's so unreliable, and what it predicts is it is every company that's tried to use it to replace customer service people has had to have customer service people come back to check what it says.
So now you get all those rehiring fees. You got
right. I mean, it does lead to temporary stock boosts, because every time you do a mass layoff, it leads to a very small blip in stock dividends, but. Again, it's temporary. Yeah. Studying what this does to long-term businesses and production, and particularly in a otherwise low commodity profit environment, if you study the history of Jack Welch, it actually is very clear. GE was destroyed by this shit. Mm. Like it turns a lot of money for a little while, but like when these people are done, there's nothing left.
Yeah,
and this is why. Chinese capitalism's out competing us, because it's basically state capitalism. And I know some of your listeners are going to be mad that I said that, but they can grow up. And like what I see communists doing in the past 5 years is defining communism in terms of acting like a state with the ability to rein its capitalist in. And that is considered common. They execute a few capitalists when they go too far. Well, we didn't execute them, but we used to put them in fucking prison for life. So, like, we just don't anymore.
We used to be communist in the antitrust era.
Well, I mean, you know, if you're a MAGA communist, they will say that we used to be communist.
Well, they'll say we are communist because of fiat currency, right? Has abolished the
value. There's fiat currency. I realized what their argument was. There's fiat currency. There's an obscure article by Ingalls in 1844 about 40 Asdenoanites that they read as Ingalls saying that communism already existed in the Americas.
Oh, cool. 1844 Ingalls, QED.
Yeah. And I'm going to say something that's going to make your left communist friends a little bit uncomfortable.
Sure, please.
This is communization theory being read through a Marxist-Leninist lens.
Damn. Mind's blown. There, like, maybe
Duvet's point about everything necessary for communism already existing in the 19th century, that's actually where it's coming from. And the fact that the weirder end of the MAGA communist patriarch socialist movement actually does seem to have some relationship to Bordigism in some weird way. You see it in their rhetoric.
Hey, at the Young Hegelian e-girls launch party here in New York City, Ross Wolf was approached by a couple of MAGA communist kids who came up to him and recognized him and said, "I love your work. I learned so much in Charnel House and Aftermath." So that's where that Ross felt a little bad about that, considering they didn't read him all that well.
Well, I've been told by many people that also that a lot of MAGA communists knew my work in the aught teens too.
Well, there you go.
Like up to and including a joke I made about the Mongol Empire. So it's a very weird milieu. But my point is, will milieus have happened before? All right.
Yeah.
And we should view this in the, you know, I'm not as pro Zizek these days, but Zizek did used to point out, you know, this was the result of failed socialism. And I do think that's true.
I think
like we're always pretending that fascism, and I do think fascism is a product of liberalism, but the fascist leadership comes out of a weird coalition of reactionaries and former socialists and communists.
Yep.
That is explicit when you look at Gentile and Mussolini. Exactly. They both come out of the maximalists. Lenin plays Gentile. Sorel's a major influence. He was a former anarcho-Marxist. There's the non-anarchist syndicalists were huge in the National Syndicalist Coalition.
Cirque we have Proudhon seen this and shit all that
before.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have seen this shit before. When there's a socialist movement that fails in the West or fails somewhere, not just in the West.
Yeah.
This goes up. And you've seen this. What this has indicated is, you know, people always talk about like this prevalence of Marxist-Leninism amongst Zoomers. And I'm like, well, it's amongst weirdo socialists, right?
Yeah.
But weirdo socialists are not as prevalent amongst Zoomers as they were amongst millennials. They're just not. And millennials are aging out of it.
Yeah.
And we're not asking where they're going. Just like we didn't ask what happened to the new communist movement.
Most of them are either going to become like Petty Van Joneses, or they're just going to get cars and houses and have children and move on with their lives. And
get like $1 million from some fund this year. I mean, you know,
doing good, man.
Was a radical Maoist. And my point looking at the DSA is I don't think it's just going to be like the right of the DSA that liquidates into the Harris campaign as their progressive candidates are losing. That has to be emphasized, that they're not doing this from a point of strength. They say they are, but they have lost. I think when we talked about the DSA before, I said that the last numbers I looked at, they were somewhere between 70 and 60,000. They're in the 50,000s now. Mm. They are back to where they were in 2017, 2018. And if you remember that DSA decline is about a year behind,
mm-hmm.
because it takes a year to fully fall off the rolls, that you're probably actually looking at like only like 30 to 40K members. And the DSA NPC seems insane these days because the factions are fighting so hard against each other on what's going on that like, one day it's like we need a global revolution and global intifada. The next day we endorse, we are taking claim for pushing Harris to the left and picking up Tim Walz.
That Walz guy. Yeah. That was a sad spectacle that we saw online.
And also from
official DSA Twitter.
Yeah, it was official.
Official statement by your organization. We're almost at an hour now. Mm-hmm. Do you want to start heading towards paywall? We'll pick this up on the other side.
Yeah, we'll pick up a paywall.
Because I think you put a very tantalizing historical analogy up there, which is like the failure of the revolutions of 1917 to 1919 and the rise of fascism on the one hand, and the decline of the Bernie movement and the rise of a nationalism-inflected Marxism-Leninism known as MAGA communism, but all other sorts of weirdness too. So we should just kind of put a pin in that. And if you are listening on the Antifada and you're not a member, a subscriber, go to patreon.com/theantifada. Do the same with Varn Vlog.
Patreon.com.
Yeah, you can watch us on video. I'm giving you a thumbs up right now on video because you just subbed. And now I'm saying you're valid. So we'll see you guys on the other side of the paywall. Thanks for listening.